Hello and welcome back to the Rusted Culture Podcast, episode 52. This is January, late in the evening, January 24th of 2018. And usually what I like to do is start off the podcast with a little bit about the Russian investigation. And to start that off, we have a story that comes to us by way of Politico. And it specifically says that Senate Democrats want to share Don Jr. transcripts with Bob Mueller. And we've got two senators, Senators Richard Blumenthal and Sheldon Whitehouse, two Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee, asked the committee's chairman, who is Republican Senator Chuck Grassley, to share transcripts of their interviews with witnesses in the Russia probe with special counsel Robert Mueller, according to Politico. And one of the transcripts they want to provide Mueller is from the committee's interview with Donald Trump Jr. And according to Politico, the request reflected the partisan tension in a judiciary committee whose investigation has for months been splintered among party lines. And Senator Blumenthal also adds that the transcript could be explosive. Well, folks, I think we can say that the feeling in the room is that we must be getting closer to wrapping up an obstruction of justice case against Donald Trump. Of course, it's speculation that a case in itself is even being formed, but I think we can all do the simple math required to form the basis for that opinion, can't we? And just, last week we had Jeff Sessions was evidently interviewed by the special counsel. And as this week unfolded, Trump's lawyers are hashing out the particulars of what and when his interview will take place. And I kind of find myself wondering how this alleged obstruction of justice case will wrap up before the Russian investigation portion of the special counsel probe. And in my view, the president has always had the option of firing Robert Mueller. Isn't this true? We know that. But let's just assume that the information gets rolled out on the obstruction of justice portion of the case first. I think that's going to be really enough in terms of validating the overall premise of the special counsel probe to allow the remainder of the investigation into the Russian portion to continue unimpeded. I think that once the first part gets done, it's going to be a lot more difficult for Trump to end the investigation at that point. So today, folks, the pressure against the FBI continues as this agency has emerged as the most hated agency of the Trump administration. They have all but identified the FBI as the enemy, not of the people, but of the administration. The Republicans, who are the best conspiracy theory birthers ever known to man, are trying everything they can to discredit the FBI. And I fought back on a lot of these myths that have been circulating. And just yesterday, for example, we had Senator Ron Johnson, who gave birth to another reckless conspiracy theory when he claimed that there's some sort of secret society. Is that like the John Birch Society? God, who knows? But anyway, he's saying some sort of secret society in the FBI that's trying to end the Trump administration. And I thought it'd be a good time. Let's just take a second here and just kind of recap the obstruction of justice premise of this probe, just for the heck of it. So the Republicans believe the dossier by Christopher Steele is what the FBI used to gain a FISA warrant to monitor members of the Trump administration, which is wrong. We know that to be wrong. The trigger that got the FBI involved was George Papadopoulos and the fact that back in May of 2016, Papadopoulos met with a top Australian diplomat confiding that the Russians had dirt on Hillary Clinton. The FBI then opened the investigation in July of 2016. And folks, let's not forget that the 17 memos that formed the infamous Russian dossier, these memos were not even finished being compiled until December of 2016. And that is according to Wikipedia. So George Papadopoulos kicked this whole thing off. The whole investigation was kicked off literally by George Papadopoulos. And next, we just learned today that it was in fact Andrew McCabe, then Deputy Director of the FBI under James Comey, who called Mike Flynn's scheduler at the White House to set up a time to speak with Mike Flynn. This explains why Trump wants McCabe fired, I think, and why he just had Jeff Sessions pressure current FBI Director Chris Wray to do so, to fire Andy McCabe, according to Axios reporting. Now, folks, keep in mind that Andrew McCabe has served the FBI flawlessly for 20 years and is set to retire in about 2 or 3 months. So, gosh, why do you think that he would want to fire Andrew McCabe that close to retirement? I think it's to show that he can reach the people that he wants to reach. Donald Trump can reach out and he can fire. And he wants to send a message, I think. By firing Andy McCabe, really nobody is safe at the FBI. I think that's the message that he's trying to send. So, in that interview that took place with the FBI that Andy McCabe set up, Michael Flynn told FBI agents, and folks, one of those FBI agents was Peter Strzok. Yes, the same Peter Strzok that Donald Trump is implicating in a conspiracy theory against him. And we've talked about that before. We've talked about the insurance policy that everybody thinks was to prevent Trump from being president, when in reality, it referred to, just for the heck of it, we got to go through, cover our fannies, and we've got to update Trump with security update. We have to give him the update. That's just what we have to do. I don't think they thought he could be elected, but just in case, they have to go through the motions and they have to give him the updates. That's what it was referring about to. We've talked about that in a previous podcast. But in that interview, Mike Flynn told FBI agents that he did not ask the Russian ambassador, Sergei Kislyak, to refrain from retaliating after the Obama administration announced sanctions against Russian meddling in the 2016 election. Sally Yates, who was the acting attorney general at that time, told Don McGahn, who was the White House counsel, that Flynn was interviewed by the FBI and that he made false statements. Now, folks, we also learned today that evidently, Michael Flynn told no one at the White House that he was interviewed by the FBI. It was a secret. So, after Sally Yates came there and told Don McGahn that, yes, Flynn was interviewed and he lied, the next day, Trump has dinner with Comey and asks for loyalty. Trump fired Mike Flynn on February 13th, and on the 14th, he met privately with James Comey, and he asked for Comey to go easy on Flynn, and then he later fires James Comey on May 9th. So as it goes here, folks, Trump knew that Flynn lied to the FBI, or at least that he was interviewed by the FBI, and according to Sally Yates, had lied to the FBI. Don McGahn, the White House lawyer, was evidently questioned by the special investigation over about 2 days, undoubtedly trying to nail down those very details. So a lot of that was just a recap, the obstruction of justice scenario that could be unfolding, but the stuff that was kind of new to me was the fact that Andrew McCabe, A, set up Flynn's interview, and B, Peter Strzok was one of Flynn's interrogators. So that certainly explains Trump's hatred for those two individuals. So in my view, folks, I think Mueller's going to try to wrap up this portion of the investigation sooner rather than later to both restore confidence in the FBI and hopefully quash Trump's daily onslaught of trying to purge people suspected of being involved in this investigation, literally to drag out in the sunlight what Trump may have been doing, if anything, it's alleged, to obstruct justice by the FBI. So having said that, Mueller still has obviously yet to interview both Sloppy Steve and Donald Trump himself. So another thing to keep in mind here is that I think the pressure that Trump and his cohorts are exerting on Chris Wray, acting director of the FBI at the moment, is in itself, it seems like an extension of the obstructing justice claim. And man, that's got to end. I've never seen anything like that, what they're doing to the FBI. And let's not forget that Obama warned Trump way in the beginning, folks. Let's not lose sight of that. Obama warned Trump not to even hire Mike Flynn, and he did. So he brought a lot of this self-inflicted pain on himself. And that's just the way it's unfolded. It's kind of sad, isn't it? I mean, a lot of this has been brought on himself. But anyway, here's a separate story, and I've got a link to this in my show notes. A German business magazine is reporting that Deutsche Bank, the German financial giant, which is a major lender to both President Donald Trump and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has identified suspicious transactions. And the suspicious transactions related to Kushner family accounts and has reported them to German banking regulators. The bank is reportedly willing to provide the information to Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller's team of investigators. That's interesting. This paper, which is actually magazine, is called Manager Magazine. It's a respected German business magazine, reported in its latest print edition, which hit German newsstands last Friday, that Paul Achleitner, who's the chairman of Deutsche Bank's board, had the bank conduct an internal investigation, and the results were troubling. And those results have since been turned over to the Federal Financial Supervisory Authority. So, of course, a spokesman for Kushner and the family has denied the transactions are indicative of any wrongdoing. So, folks, since we're talking about how most, if not all, the conspiracy theories are birthed by Republican far righties, here's some more fuel for that fire. And to that, we have Congressman Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, who recently told Fox News host Tucker Carlson that he believes Islamic State terror group masterminded the Las Vegas shooting that killed 58 people in October. Can you believe that? And to quote him, he says, "I smell a rat. Like a lot of Americans, nothing's adding up." Perry said on Thursday on Tucker Carlson Tonight, "It's been 4 months, as you said. The man's dead. They said he's a lone gunman, lone shooter, yet we can't get the autopsy results." Perry continued, "But even more troubling than that, I've been made aware of what I believe to be credible evidence, credible information regarding terrorist infiltration through the southern border regarding this incident." Ah, well, that's interesting. And Perry, as most conspiracy theories go, as they're birthed, he didn't elaborate on the credible information, nor did he try to explain what he thinks gunman Stephen Paddock, who killed himself in the massacre, wasn't acting alone. He never explained why he thinks that. Of course, the investigators tend to believe that Stephen Paddock was acting alone. So see what I mean here, folks? I mean, all the crazy talk, it used to be around these AM talk shows back in the 80s and 90s. And I grew up in Florida. Lots of old folks, retirees. And this is what they did. They listened to these AM talk shows, and they got all jazzed up, and they called in, and, they just let the steam go. But, that's what they did back then. Now it's coming directly from our senators and congressmen. It seems to be the conservative trend here, doesn't it? The more unbelievable a story is, the more inclined they are to believe it when it is birthed as a conspiracy. They're just selling crazy left and right, folks. They're just selling crazy. Well, we've got an interesting story here, and this one is coming to us from the UK. And pardon me here, but I think Theresa Major, she'd like to get a word in edgewise. And during formal phone calls between the two leaders, between Trump and Theresa May, May finds it almost impossible, we're told, to make headway and get her points across. One person that's familiar with the matter has said, "Trump totally dominates the discussion, leaving the prime minister with 5 or 10 seconds to speak before he interrupts and launches into another monologue." And reportedly, in one phone conversation that's from 2017, Trump complained to May over the criticism he'd been getting in British newspapers. Amid warnings that Trump would face protest in the streets when he arrived, he told the Prime Minister that he would not be coming to the UK until she could promise him a warm welcome. Maybe a little bit of tea and a good sticky toffee pudding might suffice. But May responded to say that such a treatment was simply the way British press operate, and there wasn't much she could do. And folks down below in the secure bunker underneath the Prime Minister's office, her advisors listened to the call in astonishment at Trump's demand. Well, you know, folks, the fight is going on. Switching gears now to the DACA kids. And I've got a story here that is on my show notes page, and it comes to you from the Daily Beast. And by far, the only group of people that are standing up for the DACA kids right now, as we know, are the Democrats. If this whole thing was left alone, all 800,000 of these kids would be sent away from literally everything they've ever known to a country they have more than likely never even been to. And the only thing that doesn't make these kids Americans is the fact that Donald Trump and people like Senator Tom Cotton and a whole host of other Republicans won't say that they're Americans. And for these kids, I think that's a travesty. This has become a one-strike-you're-out kind of a ball game with Mitch McConnell at the plate. And from Senator Lindsey Graham, who is one of the moderates that I believe kind of, at this moment, at least, I believe he supports a path to citizenship for these DACA kids. I think we need to listen carefully to what he said. He offered a scathing criticism over the weekend during the shutdown. He gave a scathing criticism of the Trump administration. And last week, Lindsey Graham basically said that the chief of staff, John Kelly and Stephen Miller, were the ones with the far-right views on DACA, as well as immigration, that are helping prevent an agreement from being struck. So those are the culprits in the White House, along, of course, with Donald Trump. They have his ear. And if you listen carefully to how the Trump administration is trying to spin this whole immigrant issue, they're continually trying to make the effort of keeping immigrants out of the USA a terrorism issue. And according to this report by the Daily Beast, Team Trump bypassed the DHS analyst to produce a bogus terror report. And, you know, folks, this is a kind of a sad commentary of the state of our administration and leadership, if you ask me. And according to this article, the Trump administration was clear. An analysis conducted by DHS concluded that 73% of terrorists were foreign-born. The only thing here, folks, is that DHS analyst had nothing to do with the conclusion. And by DHS, I mean the Department of Homeland Security. They had nothing to do with the conclusion. The document claimed that 3/4 of international terrorism convicts were immigrants, an assertion meant to bolster Donald Trump's cherished Muslim-focused ban on entering the country. And the report put the claim in the mouths of an agency assembled to keep Americans safe after 9/11, the Department of Homeland Security. Working off the 549 international terrorism convictions that were tallied by the Justice Department, the document stated, an analysis conducted by DHS determined that approximately 73%, which is 402 out of the 549 individuals, were foreign-born. But the Homeland Security did not perform that analysis. DHS's analyst did not contribute to the highly controversial report, according to the Daily Beast. And according to Charles Kurzman of the University of North Carolina, where he tracks Muslim American involvement in terrorism, he says, the Trump administration is trying to turn counterterrorism into an immigration issue, which is pretty sad. And within the DHS, the perception is that the Trump administration used the department to conflate immigrants with terrorists in support of the president's immigration crackdown. Career professional analysts at the DHS communicated to the Justice Department that the data sought for the report simply did not exist within the department. which is sad. And at the heart of this all, folks, the DACA kids are just the DACA kids, and along with just immigration in general, it's a subtle racism that they want to protect America, I think, from becoming what they have, what we've always been, which is a melting pot of different cultures. They perceive this as a threat because they feel that these people are not going to help the voting base of the Republican Party. I think Republicans feel that they will diminish their voting strength, which, by the way, is a valid concern that they have, especially here, since we can see the evidence today, right now with the DACA kids, that most Republicans want to send them back. So why would immigrants be inclined to be Republicans? I mean, I believe that theory that, yes, these immigrants see how Republicans act, and they don't want to be Republicans. The cat's kind of out of the bag. And we've just seen that they will point to reports that are basically propaganda that attempt to spin immigrants as terrorists, and the culprits are John Kelly, Jeff Sessions. And I say this sort of tongue-in-cheek, but that mean-spirited Jeff Sessions, he's a mean-spirited Keebler elf, and I just don't trust him. I don't. I'm sorry to say that. I don't trust him. And Sessions had a one-time aide. His name is Stephen Miller, who is now Trump's policy advisor. And, of course, we also have Trump himself. So those, I think, are the culprits, and that's why it's going to be so hard going forward to come up with a deal on immigration. That's just the administration. Then you have an entire host of Republicans in the Senate and the House that are literally keeping their gas tanks full, folks, in the event that they are needed to help bus DACA kids back over to Mexico. I'm afraid that's what this country has come to. That's what it's come to. And I keep saying that we hold the vote to change stuff like this. I say that time and time again. And I just want to say, give a shout out to the Women's March. I just want to say thank God for what they did. And most importantly, what they did to help lead the charge, to help register women who were there protesting, but to help register some of these women to vote. That's how it's done, folks. That's how you change the tide. If you don't like it, you got to get involved. And voting is the easiest way to do that. So I think the only path forward here, you know, we've got this whole shutdown scenario that we just went through. I think the only path forward, I mean, this is just my opinion, are short-term funding agreements until Democrats, just rolling short-term funding agreements until Democrats feel that they're being heard. And unfortunately, we don't have a lot of trust, you know, obviously with the Republicans and... you know, the one way to, I think, accomplish that, it's going to be rocky, but rolling short-term agreements, 2 weeks at a time until we get what we want, or at least a deal that is fair and balanced. And just today, Trump said that he might extend the DACA deadline, which was March 5th. He just might do that. Under what conditions, we have no idea. And folks, if you really want to know more about what Donald Trump really stands for, and I understand that this Monday they're going to come out with something definitive of what they really stand for. But for now, if you really want to know about what Trump really stands for, check out the article in my show notes page that was put together by the Cato Institute, which is a very... conservative think tank. And you can't get much more conservative than the Cato Institute. And again, that article is out there. Check it out if you want to know more about what Trump is trying to do with immigration. And just by the way, the Cato Institute, it's an American libertarian think tank that's headquartered in Washington, D.C., founded by Charles Koch in 1974. And it's basically as conservative as you might possibly could get. But there's an article out there, and it's kind of interesting that this conservative think tank is saying that Securing America's Future Act, that's what they're calling it, SAF, Securing America's Future, it's all about immigration, is net negative for the immigration system. And I'm just going to hit some of the highlights. If you want the details, check it out. But the highlights are these. They're saying that the Secure Americans Future Act, SAF, is a comprehensive immigration reform bill posing as a DACA fix. It's 414 pages long. Their article provides an extension to that if you really want to get down and dirty with some of the details. But basically, it touches on every major area of the immigration system. And I mean everything. It's all in those 414 pages. So what they're saying in this article is that in any case, SAF's negative provisions far outweigh its positive ones. And according to the article, it says the good leaves much to be desired and the bad is about as bad as it gets. So just to touch on some of the negative provisions, the authors of the bill, the SAF Act, claim that it's going to cut immigration by 25%. But in reality, the article is saying that it would be closer to 430,000 people, almost a 40% decline. And this would be the largest policy-driven reduction in legal immigration since the awful, racially motivated acts of the 1920s. And just to touch on some of the negatives of the article that they're highlighting here, the SAF also changes asylum law to make it more difficult for asylum seekers to apply by greatly increasing the standard of proof to apply for asylum. And the person that wrote this article has said that he's previously written about how these changes will make it virtually impossible for asylum seekers who don't already have attorneys waiting for them in evidence that's gathered already to prove their claims to even apply for asylum. So how many immigrants do you think are going to have, A, attorneys waiting for them, and B, evidence that's already been gathered to prove their claims to even apply for asylum? And they're saying that the worst enforcement provision is criminalizing simply being in the United States without status or violating any aspect of civil immigration law. And according to the article, again, I'm reading from it, it says, this would turn millions of unauthorized immigrants into criminals overnight. It would also criminalize legal immigrants who fail to update their addresses, carry their green card with them at all times, or otherwise abide by the million inane regulations that Congress imposes on them. And they say the worst, the icing on the cake here, folks, is take, for example, the status provided to Dreamers, the DACA kids, in this bill. It requires them to maintain an annual income of at least 125% of the poverty line. And if they fall below that level for 90 days, not only are they subject to the deportation again, but they would be considered criminals. This bill literally criminalizes poverty among Dreamers, the DACA kids. So, I mean, it's just that bad, folks. I mean, this is a conservative think tank that's saying it's just that bad. So the next thing we want to talk about is these work requirements for Medicaid. Is that a bad idea? Will they work? Well, hang in there. I'll be right back. So these work requirements for Medicaid. I've got a link to this article in my show notes. And the article was produced on March 19th of 2017. And to get an answer to that question that are work requirements for Medicaid a bad idea or a good idea? I thought, what better way to do this than to look towards a conservative study for guidance? And in this case, I'm looking at a study that was done by the conservative think tank Heritage Institute, which claims Rebecca Mercer as a board member. Many of you have heard of that name in relation to Breitbart. According to my best knowledge, I believe she is also on the board of Breitbart and was instrumental in getting rid of Steve Bannon from Breitbart. But according to Politico here, folks, on November 22nd of 2016, three sources from different conservative groups said that Heritage employees have been soliciting, stockpiling, and vetting resumes for months with an eye on stacking Trump's administration with conservative appointees across the government effort to have the right kind of people in the Trump administration. So I'm just saying that so that we can suffice it to say that the Heritage Foundation is sufficiently conservative. And recent reports indicate that the Trump administration and House Republicans are considering work requirements in Medicaid as part of their overall health care reform package. And we've heard about this with Kentucky, and Governor Matt Bevin is one of the first ones to promote this, work requirements in Medicaid. And according to this article, under the proposed policy, governors would be given the option of requiring able-bodied adults without dependent children enrolled in Medicaid to hold a job, perform community service, or undertake training as a condition of receiving Medicaid services. While the idea of requiring work, training, or other constructive activity in exchange for benefits is sound in principle, there are numerous reasons why this policy would prove ineffective. Moreover, there are better ways to promote work in the context of healthcare reform debate. And again, this article says that first, the proposed policy is optional. Most governors will simply just ignore it. Second, the requirements for medical services would become almost impossible to administer and enforce. And it says that in reality, it's difficult to get eligible able-bodied adults without independent children to enroll in Medicaid. After all, they don't need to enroll in the program to receive free medical care. They know that if they get sick and walk into a clinic or emergency room, they're going to get enrolled in Medicaid prospectively or receive treatment pro bono. And a work requirement, the article says, would just make it less likely for able-bodied adults without dependent children to register for the program. The work requirement would reduce Medicaid enrollments, but Medicaid costs might well go up because the eligible able-bodied adults without children or dependents would go to the emergency room rather than receive routine care elsewhere. That's an interesting point, that it actually might be more expensive in the long run. And ultimately, to put this in a nutshell, what they would like to do in this article, and we kind of knew this was coming, they would like to use work requirements for food stamps. And they're pointing to a 2014 situation in Maine where they implemented work requirements on these able-bodied adults with no dependents into the state's food stamp program. And they point to how they thought that was a raging success. So they really say that what they'd like to do is use this instead for food stamps. And the article goes on to say that Congress faces a choice between an optional, non-enforceable work requirement on medical care provided to non-working, able-bodied adults without dependents as a mandatory, enforceable work group requirement on the food stamp benefit received by this same group. The former policy is empty symbolism that it will accomplish nothing. The latter is an ineffective, proven policy that will change welfare and save the taxpayers billions, according to this article. So they're saying that health work requirements around Medicaid is empty symbolism. And that is coming from the Cato Institute. Interesting. But yet we march on, don't we? Yes, we do. Try to take that study and show it to somebody like Donald Trump and see if that makes any sense. Just try that. So before leaving today, you know what I'd like to do? Let's just check up on what old Rush Limbaugh is up to and what he's saying today. And guess what I found? And a lot of other Republicans, including a particularly nasty one, and I think he's nasty anyway, Roger Stone. Oh, God. I don't like Roger Stone. I mean, there's a lot of reasons behind that. Lawrence O'Donnell, in his show the other day, he covered some of those reasons, and I'm not going to go into them. You can Google that. But I'm not a fan. But anyway, Roger Stone, Rush Limbaugh, some of the other Republicans, you know what they're saying? They're saying, "Don't, Mr. President, don't talk to Mueller. Sir, it's a perjury trap." So that's what they're all saying in concert. And I just find that amazing. I mean, really, all you have to do is tell the truth, Mr. President. And it sounds like when you hear him talk just today, that's what he's going to do. I and he wants to do it. But they're saying, don't talk to Mueller, Mr. President. Sir, it's a perjury trap. You know, if it's that hard to do, really, maybe just stay home on the third floor of the White House with your TV clicker and have a few cheeseburgers and a malt. I mean, really. It's just telling the truth, right? Okay. So, anyway, by the way, there's an update on Stormy Daniels, and we just can't go without some of that, can we? I mean, Stormygate, it just keeps on, it's, like I said, the gift that just keeps on going. And most of you know the whole issue with Stormy Daniels, but today, the Common Cause filed, a group called the Common Cause, filed complaints with the Department of Justice and the Federal Election Commission, alleging that the payment of $130,000 to Stephanie Clifford, who is also known as Stormy Daniels, that payment was made through an LLC. It was an unreported in-kind contribution to President Trump's 2016 presidential campaign committee in violation of the Federal Election Campaign Act. The complaint also asked the agencies to determine whether the payment was made by the Trump Organization or some other corporation or individual, which would additionally make it an illegal in-kind contribution to the campaign. And corporations are prohibited from contributing to candidates, and individual contributions, as we know, are limited to $2,700. And the complaint says that the Department of Justice and the Federal Election Commission need to review the payment since the funds were used for the purpose of influencing the election. Wow, and that's coming to us from Mother Jones. And you know, they also included a little tidbit that they found. And this little tidbit is coming from the Citizens for Ethics. And in their tweet, they said something like, President Trump is accused of paying $130,000 in hush money to porn star Stormy Daniels to hide an affair a month before the election. In what probably is just a coincidence or speculation, the Trump campaign transferred $130,000 to the Trump businesses a month after the election. And they show a print screen of this $130,888.33 that came from Trump Tower Commercial LLC on December 21st of 2016. And disbursement was for general. They checked that box, general. So the speculation here in this Mother Jones article is that maybe the Trump Organization paid off Stormy and then got reimbursed by the campaign. And it just keeps on going. So I guess the question that I have to ask, you know, is if this turns out to show that Trump lied, you know, that he lied about the affair, that he lied about the amount of money allegedly paid in hush money, what will the evangelicals do next? I mean, what will the evangelicals do with this kind of information? Folks, I really don't know the answer to that, and we're talking, we'll just have to wait and see. But that's an interesting question. What will they do? And I just want to thank you for joining us once again. And as you can tell, love is in the air. And folks, I want to thank you. Until then, we'll see you next time.